As we continue on this seminar regarding ingredients for successful clinical supervision, we're going to talk next about the developmental stages of supervisees. Usually supervisees come in feeling what the literature would call stagnated, especially if they've not had experience before. Maybe they've never met with a client. Maybe all they have in their toolbox is the theoretical knowledge of what they've received at school. So they're feeling stuck. There's this apprehension of, gosh, what if I were to try and have my own client with supervision? You know, would I mess it up? Would I be able to apply the theories? How would I handle it? Then eventually it transitions to a point of, after some time, after being able to meet with some clients under supervision, where they feel like they can sort of do some stuff, but they're still having some uncertainty or confusion about what they know, what they don't know, how to make the choices about when to apply what techniques. And then finally, we move to the third stage, which is called integration. So in terms of the first stage, as I talked about, the stagnation, there's basically lack of awareness regarding possible underlying issues that a client might be coming to them with in a session. I found that when I've worked with supervisees at this early developmental stage, they tend to focus so much on the theories and tend to lump certain types of clients into a category. So, for example, when they come to me for supervision, they have in the past said things like, how do you work with a client who's having a rough marriage? What do you do for people who can't communicate well with others? How do you handle someone with depression? And as you know, if we've been in the counseling and psychotherapy field for a while, everyone who has marriage problems is definitely not the same. Everyone with communication issues is not the same. Or everyone who's going through depression is not the same. So it's very challenging at this early stage of supervision for supervisees to get out of this linear thinking. They kind of look at things as, there's a problem, what's the solution? And we know there's many solutions. We know there's different theories that can be applied. And how do we pair that up with that given client? Supervisees at this stage tend to have very black and white concrete thinking. As a clinician, they have at this first stage a low self-concept and a high sense of dependency on someone as a supervisor. The self-awareness is low, and they're going to put their supervisor on this pedestal, seeing him or her as all-knowing, all-wise, able to basically solve almost any problem. Then, over time, as they gain some experience, as they go through that trial and error, and we work with them with regard to skill building and skill development, they have a sense of, yeah, I can actually help someone. The reasons I went into the field are coming forth. I feel like I can make some difference in someone's life. There is something that I've offered a client. I'm seeing some progress in some sessions. But there's still part of them that still feels like they're failing, that they're not measuring up. They're blaming themselves for in-between sessions where sometimes it's not always going smoothly, where there are some setbacks. So there tends to be this fluctuation between I helped and I failed. At this stage two of the developmental stages of supervisees, supervisees have a sense of instability and disorganization. They still realize they don't have all the solutions, and they don't know how to apply all the techniques and the theoretical knowledge. So there is still quite a sense of dependency on the supervisor, but there's more readiness and willingness for them to step out and try and grow. Finally, when we're talking more about that last stage, we're usually talking about a sense of supervision where the supervisor might be a little more experienced, have a little broader sense of knowledge and application. So it's more almost like a consultant relationship. The supervisee has gained a better sense of what theories to apply when, how to really place clinical cases in a contextual concept, how to see problems with having many angles, and having a sober judgment of their own sense of strengths and weaknesses. So when we're looking at considering what developmental level a supervisee might be at, we're looking at three different areas. What would be a legitimate sense of autonomy? Obviously, we don't want a supervisee to be acting too autonomous too early on if they don't have a sound sense of, from the research background, from the evidence of what types of techniques, of what types of things need to be applied when. We want them still to rely on the supervisor and consult with the supervisor. You know, keep in mind, the supervisor is going to basically have secondary responsibility for whatever the supervisee does. So we really want the supervisee to operate at an appropriate level of autonomy. Next, complexity. We may have to screen what types of cases would be appropriate for a supervisee. So basically, there needs to be a balance between how do we know when to push that supervisee a little out of their comfort zone to start learning new things and applying new things, but then also when to realize that they might need some more skill development before they're ready to go out on their own in certain areas. We also need to assess the vulnerability and the risk, both for them as well as the clients they may be seeing. A systematic training program for supervision would have several different elements to it. As I said, there's so many different elements of skill building and skill enhancement with supervisees. So one element is skills development. As we know, everything can't possibly be taught in a bachelor's or master's program pre-licensure. And there's so many different venues that we work at clinically. You know, something like community mental health is very different from private practice. Private practice is very different from working in a private agency. A private agency is very different from working at a nonprofit. A nonprofit's different from working at a hospital. So skill development may be different depending on the venue, may be different depending on the type of clientele, the issues that are being brought in. Are there risk issues? Are there safety issues? Could there be issues with violence? Are these clients coming in willingly or not? So skill development's very important. Role modeling. I can't highlight enough that one ingredient of a good supervisor and a good supervision relationship is that the supervisor role models in practical life and in the clinical setting what they want that supervisee to be doing. So it's one thing for a supervisor to say, do A, B, and C, but then when that supervisee looks at the supervisor and says, well, gosh, I don't really see them doing this, you know, how do they handle it? So then there needs to be some level of helping the supervisee step out. So some practicum, some internship, where they're learning to develop that level of autonomy. Then eventually opportunities for mastery. So even if a supervisee is becoming more experienced, how do we continue to stretch that and develop that to where they can progress to that third level of development? Self-monitoring. I think this is one of the more challenging ones because this goes back to what we talked about in the first session of the seminar in terms of how does the supervisee know what to bring to supervision? How do they know what areas they're strong or weak in? This might be something as a supervisor that you need to talk with the supervisee about, that how do they know what areas they might need more help with. And then finally, developing sober judgment of one's clinical abilities. I tend to use a lot of we language when I have supervised people in the past. With the we language, I'll say, you know, all of us that have worked in the mental health field have sometimes where we feel like, gosh, I thought what I was doing was helpful, but this client's reacting a certain way. So using role modeling, you know, having a realistic idea about what I can help, what I can't, what's within my scope of practice. It's not our job to take on everything. It's our job to know what we know, but also to be well aware of what we don't know and to be humble about it and know when to refer out or when to consult with someone else. So we've talked in general about therapeutic alliance, but there's also something in the literature called supervisory working alliance. So over time, there should be this sense in a supervision relationship of a bond that's formed between the supervisee and the supervisor, specifically surrounding training goals, surrounding work with clients, and whatever the setting is. So then, through that bond, agreed upon goals happen. But then within those goals, the supervisor and supervisees may have some different ideas how to get to the task. So it's a matter of sorting through what's the task. You know, if it's how do I get through my internship? How do I get my hours for licensure? So we're wanting to come up with agreed upon tasks. And that's where the bond is formed. So it's much like, and this is just an analogy, but it's much like with a clinician and a client where they're developing a treatment plan. It's sort of like, for lack of a better term, a treatment plan for the supervision relationship. Now, I have included a few audios that I think would be very helpful. I have interviewed a supervisee that I've worked with in the past, and she talked a lot about what she felt supervisees need from supervision. So I would highly encourage you to listen to that. I think it'll give you some insight about what they find helpful and what's not helpful. Then I also have included an interview of someone who has been a clinical supervisor about what are the elements that a supervisor needs for effective supervision. So let's look at some theories of supervision. Most of the theories that I've seen out there have tended to be developmental. As I alluded to before and talked about the movement of the supervisee from confusion to integration, we're talking about developmental theories. Now, another type of theory that's out there is the integrated theory, where the supervisor is a teacher and instructor. So basically just looking at specific blind spots or areas that need to be developed. And then rarely there are some what they call orientation-specific models. Some people are tied to certain theories. And so there are some supervision models that tend to be linked to certain specific theories. So when we're working with a supervisee, we're looking at their developmental level. We're looking at how to be supportive with minimal confrontation and then skill building. I'm going to allude to some different types of developmental models first here that are common in the literature. So one is a model by Littrell, Lee Borden, and Lorenz. In this model, the supervisors match their roles to those needed by the supervisees. They move from just shallowly imitating to really tailoring to their clients what they need. It starts out in the first stage of this model that the supervisor is a teacher and a counselor. And when I say counselor, I don't mean a clinical counselor. I mean that they're a go-to person, a role model, someone who's providing direction, very specifically about how things need to be done. There's goals and conditions for supervision. This could be stuff that their school, that the board, that the community or the agency are saying. So as they progress along, We're filtering through as a supervisor what are the skill deficit areas and how to focus on those. And then as we move along, just like I mentioned with that general developmental approach earlier, the supervisor becomes more of a collaborative consultant. And there's a move towards increasing self-monitoring in the supervisee. Finally, let's say there's a clinical supervision relationship among two independently licensed people or people who've been in the mental health field for a while. Eventually, the supervision relationship becomes more one where they're distant consultants, where it's more of a collaboration. And this generally is more for the purpose of developing a scope of practice and for making sure that things are done ethically and with accountability. This, I think, is important because that way, if there ever is an ethical allegation, it can be documented that we were consulting and what was happening. Another name in the developmental supervision literature is Bernard. He talks about three foci for supervision. The first focus area he talks about is development of intervention skills. So simple things like how do you use reflections? How do you probe when you need to ask for more in a certain area if you're doing an assessment? Or if there's an area a client hasn't talked about that needs to be explored? What do you do in terms of restating things or summarizing them? And how to look at the nonverbals of a client? Another thing that he looks at, or a second focus area, is that of conceptualization skills. This is what I alluded to when I was talking about the supervisee's progression developmentally, where they don't see just a case narrowly. They're able to find themes. They're able to look at what are the client concerns and how do I match a goal with a theoretical approach, or how do I individualize a treatment plan and application of that treatment plan to a given client. So goal setting, goal development, modification of the goals, and then having an ongoing plan. Another area is personalization. This has to do with the supervisee's development personally and professionally. I think it's useful to have some discussion with a supervisee about why he or she even went into the field to begin with, and helping that person to take responsibility and direction for the outcomes of sessions, helping them know how to hear feedback and not be defensive about it, helping the supervisee know how to self-analyze, how to be honest with themselves about what their strength and weakness areas are. And since this can be a challenge, how to be able to hear the feedback of others so that they are not defensive about when there's an area that they might be blind about. Then also with personalization skills, we're looking at effectively combining personal style with client goals and treatment, and basically developing their identity as a professional counselor. Another type of developmental model that's out there is the one of Nelson, Johnson, and Thorngren. They're looking at four non-sequential stages. So one is orientation, just setting the goals. Basically, again, in this, the supervisor would be more of an experienced teacher. Next, they're looking at the category of working. How do we do the work or the intervention part, the assessment part and intervention part of being a clinician? How do we really conceptualize client behaviors, both verbally and nonverbally, the diagnosis, the treatment planning, looking at skill development, and then looking at those three focus areas that we talked about a little bit ago in Bernard's model? Then we're also looking at the third stage in the Nelson, Johnson, and Thorngren model, where there's more independent thinking on the part of the supervisee. So one of the things that you may notice is there's a lot of commonalities among these developmental stages. And hopefully you have noticed that, because really that's what we're trying to do, is find out where the supervisee's at, how do we meet them or start with them where they're at, and then eventually move them to a little more developed, higher level in their developmental stages. We talked about that there are some theoretical orientation types of supervision approach, and one is the Erickson model. Eric Erickson talks about developmental supervision, but just like his stages of development among people, he mirrors those in supervision. So he starts with the first stage of trust versus mistrust. And basically, he talks about supervisees come to us at the beginning as anxious individuals. We're trying to reduce the overall level of supervisee anxiety. They're distrustful. When they first come there, they just see the supervisor as someone who's evaluating, as someone who's ready to ding them when they're not doing the right thing. Then they can move to a place of autonomy versus shame and doubt, helping them to build up their skill level, to not be fearful of realistic constructive criticism, and to move towards a little bit more autonomous decision making. Then the next stage that he uses is initiative versus guilt. Hopefully over time, the supervisee becomes a little more confident and willing to engage in some new learning opportunities. Then they move towards industry versus inferiority. This is where the place of personal and professional growth occurs. Over time, there may be a sense of narrowing down who the person is as a professional. After maybe several years even, something might change where initially someone might say, I went into the field for such and such reason. And then later they find out, you know what? I think I want to change this or shift this a little. So this is the phase of generally the more experienced clinician. Then he talks about intimacy versus isolation. This is a place of ongoing commitment to development of your personal and professional character. And finally, generativity versus stagnation. This is where you've been in the field a while, you have a fairly good sense of who you are as a clinician, and now you're ready to pass on some knowledge to the next generation of counselors. Besides Erickson's model, I also wanted to talk a little about the Adlerian model of supervision. This is very evaluation-focused, it's very experiential, and it's looking at developing solutions that work, having honest feedback, and doing a back-and-forth questioning between the supervisor and supervisee. So there's different categories that are in it. Again, it's not a stages model, though. It's not step one, step two, step three. There's several areas I'll talk about that it all simultaneously looks at. And one of those areas is goals. We obviously have to do goals anyway with treatment planning, so it would be important for us to look at the goals in a given setting or with a client of a supervisee, a supervisor, the client's goals, the expected outcomes. And those are areas we should be not just assessing initially during the psychosocial assessment part or during the beginning of the supervision arrangement, but those should be reassessed and reassessed. It's important to return to original schemas and goals when needed to see what might need to be modified. Then we're talking about social interest. How can a supervisor and supervisee really engage as a team to focus on what's best for the client? So looking at what resources might be in the community, maybe social justice areas of helping a client access certain things. And then it's looking at also your lifestyle orientation, personal beliefs, values, and opinions, how they may or may not affect the clinical relationship. Another area in this Adlerian model is a style of counseling. So counseling process issues, going through different phases in counseling, readiness for the client to apply different techniques, case conceptualization, if goals are attainable or not, if assumptions about the counseling process in a given case need to be tested or redone. And then style reformation. Sometimes we need to keep reevaluating things. So changing things to things that are more empathic and therapeutic for a given situation and a given person. Another element which I like that the Adlerian model really focuses quite a bit on is that of encouragement. So this highlights again, not just skill building, not just teaching new concepts and role modeling new concepts to the supervisee, but also encouraging them, also building up what they already know. I've had so many supervisees who were actually applying a technique or doing something pretty well. Maybe they didn't know the name of the theory or who did what, you know, according to the books, but they were affirming, but they were doing something that made a difference in the life of the client. So helping in a very concrete behavioral way to affirm what the supervisee is doing that's helpful. Another model of supervision, and this one I really, really like because it looks at several different areas and really individualizes to the supervisee, is a more recent model of supervision called the synergistic model of supervision. So it's balancing us helping in terms of content and skill building with looking at the process. There's three elements to it, and I'll explain each of those in detail in a moment. The first one is looking at Bloom's taxonomy. If you're not aware of what Bloom's taxonomy is basically like, say you're going through school and there's different levels of knowledge on a topic. When you first know a topic, you may just be memorizing a definition. You may not really understand how to apply that topic or compare and contrast it to something else or to conceptualize what it would look like. So Bloom's taxonomy actually looks at increasingly complex goals as someone moves along the levels of development. Then the next thing we'll talk about after we go in detail with the Bloom's taxonomy, the second critical element of the synergistic model, is the heuristic model of interpersonal development. And this really talks about the dynamic that the supervisor and the supervisee have amongst themselves. And then third, developing multicultural competencies. So with Bloom's taxonomy, let me go through that just to make sure that you're clear what that involves. We're talking about increasing cognitive complexity. So initially, let's say someone is a supervisee and they've never ever met with a client. They might just have memorized in their college classes what cognitive behavioral meant. But maybe they don't have a concept of how do you teach this idea about thoughts and feelings and behaviors and how they're related to a client. How do you actually help them have exercises to apply this? So initially with Bloom's taxonomy, we're talking about simple recall, memorizing the definition from the book. What is this? How is it defined? Now that doesn't mean you really understand it or you can apply it. Then we're moving towards comprehension, which is more understanding. Oh, I get it. It's not just for cognitive behavioral. It's not just explaining the definition from the book, but it's showing that it's not your feelings that actually determine your life, but how you process the feelings through your behavior choices and your thoughts. Okay. Then applying, if let's say a supervisee is able to apply this to a situation. Maybe they say that a job loss, that someone feels really depressed and feels like their life is never going to be good. They might be able to give that as an example to say, is it the job loss that caused your depression? Well, actually, according to cognitive behavioral therapy, it's more the way you process it and saying, my life will never be good. Now everything's awful. It's what you tell yourself. It's the behaviors that you choose. Instead of sitting at home and not applying for a new job, or instead of crying and thinking about that you failed, what are some other ways that we could approach the thoughts and the behaviors? So actually realizing how you can apply things. Then analysis would be the next most advanced level of Bloom's taxonomy. Looking at the material and breaking it down into parts. Synthesis, integrating things. So that would be more of someone being able to explain, why would I choose possibly cognitive behavioral therapy for this given client versus solution focused? What are the pros and cons of each? And then evaluation. So it keeps getting more serious on a developmental level. So let me go to some examples of what that would look like in practice. So initially, if someone was just at the knowledge level, they might be looking at like a supervisor saying, what do you know about cognitive behavioral therapy? When you hear those words, what does that mean to you? So just the definition. Then comprehending things. Why do you think a cognitive behavioral approach might work better with a client who's telling themselves negative things and feels depressed? So that when they have to understand it and be able to kind of see behind what the meaning is. Then application. Can you give me an example of how we might use the cognitive behavioral therapy with a depressed person? Then we're moving towards analysis. Can you compare and contrast what might be the positives or negatives of cognitive behavioral work with this given client versus maybe using another approach? Then synthesis. Can you hypothesize how using cognitive behavioral work with someone with a low intellectual level may not be the best approach for him or her? An evaluation. According to so-and-so's article on cognitive behavioral work, how might you reevaluate your work with so-and-so client? So you see it's getting towards a more serious developmental level as it goes along. Then in this next element of the synergistic model, we're looking at what the levels of development are simultaneously that a supervisor and a supervisee might be at. It's okay if they're at different levels. There's different levels of experience. There's different settings. There's different types of clientele they both brought to the table. So we may have to actually delve into what are some of the stereotypes that a supervisor versus a supervisee has about clients. What if there's some incongruence between beliefs and behaviors? How to work with people with differences. And this isn't just in the relationship with our clients, but in the supervision relationship. There's times it's useful to bring up and to work on when you know that a supervisor and a supervisee might have a little bit of different take on something. How do we do that but still be effective for our client? And then the final area of the synergistic model is this multicultural component. I briefly alluded to that earlier, and I would encourage you to go on my website and look at the video regarding multicultural competency. I do want to be very clear that multicultural effective client working with clients has to do with understanding what multicultural or what cultural is. Culture is defined as the way a group of people do anything. So this, in the past, the literature used to look at things like race and ethnicity. But I'm talking in a much broader level. You could have a music culture. Think of these music festivals that people go to. Some people might have a certain style of music, and you might get a picture in your head about the group of people who listen to a certain type of music, how they dress, how they act, what their behaviors are around that type of genre of music. You might have a culture of people who practice in the mental health field. How do they seem to be versus someone who works in a factory versus someone who does another type of job? What community does someone live in? What is their socioeconomic status? Their religious values? Their beliefs on anything? The hobbies they have? So there's just so many different areas that may have to do with culture. So just keep that in mind as you work with a client. There are several general competencies that are really important when we're talking about supervision. So we're talking about enhancing the learning of a supervisee, making sure that they are doing things ethically. We're talking about fostering competence. So that both means role modeling, only working in areas the supervisor's competent in, and only supervising those, as well as helping teach areas for development that the supervisee may need. Then adapting supervision to the different context. Like I said, different organizations are going to be really different in terms of how they approach things. Forming a supervisory alliance. Helping the client present information about how we do clinical work. Looking at the different methods and techniques. And then the self-evaluation component. Helping supervisees practice clinical skills. And then supervision in individual as well as sometimes possibly group formats. We're looking at how to give and receive feedback. How to draw on questions, how to possibly use evaluations or rating scales to do assessment, how to draw on our knowledge, how to know the strengths and weaknesses of different things, different techniques. One of the things I thought was interesting, and this is a much more recent model of supervision out there, was this experiential adventure-based model. I thought that name was cool in and of itself. It's kind of thrilling when you think of supervision as an adventure process. So basically what they're talking about is you go into supervision with this idea of this narrative of what is it that I'm hoping to do? Why did I go into the field? And then eventually the concept of walking out the supervision journey. They talk about starting with the assessment adventure, kind of getting to know the story or the narrative of a client, then building on your thoughts, your intuition, what can you figure out, what do you know, how can you develop and hear the story of the client, enhancing your analytical skills, matching a theory and technique to the client. So learning more, becoming more effective. With this, we're talking about we can make some changes with the client in the context in which they're doing behaviors and our hypothesis about why a client's doing something or not and our actions about how to react to certain things they're bringing into things, about evaluation and solutions. So this is one of the ways we're looking at it. And we're looking at in supervision that we're co-creating an adventure. The supervisor and supervisee in this model are seen as a team, listening to the client concerns and creating this adventure in the setting of the counseling with the client. There also is out there in a more recent supervision model, the wellness model of supervision. And I would encourage you, whether you're at an earlier level of development, or whether you've been in the field a while, to really think of how you conceptualize in a concrete behavioral way the definition of wellness. What that means for you. Because that can make a difference. what is wellness to you versus how the client might develop wellness. If you were to ask that client, when's a time they felt more like they would like to feel, or life was going more along how they wanted, what did that look like? The client's definition of wellness versus a supervisee and the supervisor may be different. Ideally, if we're having a healthy supervision relationship, the supervisor should be modeling wellness. That's not always easy to do when supervisors are pulled a lot of different directions, when there's time pressures, when there's issues with clients, when supervisees have evaluations and requirements for school. So there's a lot of different considerations there. Now, there are some types of supervision models out there, and I just want to give you some examples of this, that tend to focus on specific issues. For example, there's a model out there that was developed in 2010 called the 5-step model for addictions. I found this interesting because it highlights some of the components specifically with clients that come in for addiction that are really important. So the first one has to do with listening. A lot of people that maybe have relapsed on a substance or are coming in for help to try and have sobriety are feeling defeated. So this first step of listening is very important according to this model. It includes valuing the stories of both the client and his or her family or support system. And there may be different stories there. You know, you might have a family system that's fed up because here we go again, this person's using the substance. You might have the client feeling defeated. We're looking at stressors. We're looking at needs. We're looking at what do we need to do from here. Then we're providing targeted information. A client may or may not know what addiction entails. They may have some misperceptions. People around them might have some misperceptions and may have thought, well, gosh, if you had the willpower, then you wouldn't continue to use these substances. So we're providing some information. And then third, we're looking at coping responses. What are different alternative coping responses? So not, you know, there's several. It could be standing up to the addiction. Some people just put up with it or tolerate it. Sometimes tough love might be needed. Withdrawal, detox. So we're also looking at, with this 5-step model, step 4, social supports. A lot of people with addiction don't always feel they have that many social supports. So assessing that and connecting them with social supports. That might be a treatment group. That might be an intensive outpatient or a partial hospitalization program. Then step 5, looking at future needs. One of the things I find interesting too is there's another type of supervision model that's more recent that uses expressive arts in group supervision. Just like we find with some clients, it's easier for them to talk about certain issues through use of arts, through use of role play, through use of creative means and metaphor. We have found out in some of the literature that some supervisees really do better when art is involved. So we're looking at the visual, at music, at media, and symbolism. An example of this might be in a group supervision setting to do something like drawing out the different feelings about supervision, about the new quarter or semester of school, about having your own client, about client relationships in general, about dealing with certain types of clients. And then after that's done, and you see the different colors that are used, the way the lines are, the way whatever's drawn out is done, then that will be presented to the group and used as a forum for discussion. Other types of things that could be used in this expressive arts group would be counseling images. That could be clipping items or metaphors from a magazine. That could be words. But the idea is, how do you see yourself as a counselor, as a clinician? and then to kind of make a collage or make a picture that's representative of that. Counselor identity. Talking about doing a presentation about that. Using media clips, songs, or other things to define the journey of counselor identity. Overcoming obstacles. This would be something you might do a little bit further along in the developmental process, but overcoming obstacles and then exploring those. Because it's interesting, there may be certain things that a supervisee sees as an obstacle that many other supervisees see as obstacles. There may be some that might be different. And then another exercise that can be done is an exercise about symbolisms of growth. What will represent growth? So there's a lot of different ways to look at things. Another theoretical model, like the Erickson model that I talked about earlier, is a Gestalt model. In Gestalt supervision, we're expanding awareness of verbals and nonverbals. So there might be metaphors, there might be dreams or thoughts or worries that a supervisee has. And oftentimes it's a matter of, in group supervision, doing what they call creative experiments. Sometimes this is done through role playing. They gave an example in the article that I listed on the PowerPoint there by Melnick and Fall about what they call the gorilla girl. There was a girl who was having dreams about this big gorilla chasing her. And they used that analogy in the group to do some role plays. And through the role plays, they basically processed and found out that she was just feeling overwhelmed about school, about all these different requirements that she was having to do. With groups, what's interesting is that the leader of the group or the supervisor can point out dynamics of what might be happening within a given supervisee, or within multiple people, if a few of the people in the group tend to have a similar experience, or in a subgroup, or things that are unanimous across the group. Another type of supervision I found fascinating was that of video journaling. I just think with the use of technology increasing, this is something that is becoming more and more interesting. What's cool about it is that we're seeing raw in the moment reactions. They talked about, for example, initially maybe taking a video or self video of what it's like before you start a practicum or internship. What it's like going into trying to do certain techniques with a client. So dealing with the intricacies of working with different populations, with different issues, and then through the process of maybe doing an internship or over time, looking at the development of those videos. Computer-based supervision. Face-to-face supervision, let me say, should be the modality of supervision. But there are times when, if confidentiality is protected, it might be important for a supervisor and a supervisee to check in via email or technology, maybe doing teleconferencing or video conferencing. So those would be adjuncts. I do have to make sure that you understand, though, that with computer-based supervision, we do have to adhere to the ethical standards regarding confidentiality of the supervision relationship, of clients' issues and names and information. There should be disclaimers. There's the issues of liability. And then there's the realistic issue of technological know-how. Supervision also can be useful in crisis situations. For one, any of us can get in a situation that quickly can become kind of panicked. And what supervision does is it can normalize those clinical experiences, can allow for processing. It can help the supervisee get back onto what's going on with the symptoms, with the agency, with, how do we get back to procedure? I think sometimes focusing on policy and procedure in the crisis times can really help normalize things. Sometimes in crisis times, one of the things also that a supervisor can help with is awareness of community resources. Then development of resiliency. Oftentimes, if you talk with someone who's worked in the mental health field, it's not that they felt they knew everything so well and were an expert, but that they became resilient as they were exposed to more types of situations, more clientele, more new experiences. And not just resiliency, but even in some cases, post-traumatic growth. Sometimes even dealing with some of those really extreme rough cases can give you a sense of feeling even more competent, feeling more effective, and looking at a different way of some of the stuff that we were approaching before. What's good about the supervision relationship and making use of it, even not at the scheduled times just, but when there is a crisis, is it can prevent burnout. Some of the thoughts that people have when they're going through burnout is, I have to handle everything, I got to be on call 24 hours, I have to be at my best at all times. And those are not rational, realistic thoughts. So preventing burnout is important. And then knowing what developmental level one's at. Why is clinical supervision so important when there's crisis? Crisis can trigger unresolved conflicts. And we all may have, to some degree in our life, some unfinished business. Sometimes with crisis, we might have to go into our own personal counseling. There might be something we need to look at. Crisis can be pressuresome. I always tell people when there's pressure placed on something, it squeezes and whatever's inside of you comes out. Meaning that if you're patient, if you're, you know, have certain qualities that help you be effective, that will come out even in the most pressuresome. But if you're insecure, if you have unresolved business, that's going to come out too. So it's very important to have that accountability and supervision. Crisis also is something that's really key with supervision is because the supervisee needs to know how to do behavior de-escalation. There's times clients can become so amped up about something, and it is our ethical responsibility to make sure that they're de-escalated. Crisis might look different from culture to culture, or what's defined as a crisis. So it's important to hear the client's narrative on that. But the key is seeing crisis as an opportunity for growth. One of the things that supervisors also have to do is make sure they're setting boundaries. The supervision relationship is not a counseling relationship. It's not a friendship. There are professional ethical standards. Even though there's an evaluation component, ethical supervisors need to reduce the likelihood of exploitation. They need to avoid dual relationships, especially sexual relationships. They need to not be supervising relatives. And if things like writing a book or doing research are involved in the clinical supervision, if the supervisee's helping, like say they're a research assistant or they're an assistant in writing some literature, there needs to be honest credit and citation to sources. There's also that component of evaluation. So the supervisor needs to make sure that the supervisee understands that the evaluation of the board or to school will be honest, even if a person is not necessarily recommended for licensure. The other thing that's been more recently highlighted in the literature is that with supervision, it should be a two-way evaluation, meaning that maybe there should be some goals for the supervisor. Maybe there should be a means where the supervisee can check back in and be giving his or her feedback as well. Some things that are important to consider in supervision are that there is a sense of vicarious responsibility. But while that comes back on the supervisor, there's issues of due process afforded a supervisee. We need to make sure and hear their side of things. We need to make sure that at all levels it's been clear with the client that what the supervision relationship is. I can't say enough, as I say in my ethics seminar, that having something like a bio or a little sheet on each supervisee can be very helpful. If you're doing ongoing counseling with someone, have a bio. Hi, my name is so-and-so. I am in such and such school towards my licensure. I need this many hours. I'm working under the supervision of so-and-so. The types of clients I see under supervision are da-da-da-da. So have something in writing. That way you can give something to the clients. You can document in the folder, in the client chart that they've been given that. So ethical consideration of supervision, avoiding dual relationships, only operating in areas of competency with the supervisor and supervisee, and then confidentiality. Now, one of the important studies I wanted to bring up, and I really like bringing this study up because it really creates some discussion, is, and I want you to think of the answer before we really go through this. If an anonymous study was done and supervisees were asked about, have you ever intentionally non-disclosed important information, like mistakes, personal problems, negative reactions by a client, countertransference, sexual attraction to clients, or not really, you know, noted every aspect of the clinical relationship the way you should, in cases of harm to self or others, or operated in an inappropriate level of autonomy. How much do you think, what percentage of supervisees intentionally non-disclose those things? Well, in this study that I cite here, they found that 97.2% of those surveyed of supervisees did admit to that. They admitted to sometimes, because they're being evaluated, not disclosing clinical mistakes, not disclosing times where they've had countertransference, not disclosing times where they thought, oh man, I should have noted this, or I should have written more in my notes, not disclosing when they had some personal issues that might affect the clinical relationship, not disclosing when there were other issues like forging documentation, like talking trash about the agency, or gossiping or talking nonsense with colleagues. The two most important reasons, though there were several if you were to read this article that they talked about, were that supervisees said, I want to avoid confrontation and I feel ashamed. I bring up this article when I've ever interviewed a potential supervisee. I bring up this article because I say, you know, there is a legitimate concern that supervisees have of how do I bring up my concerns? How do I ask for help? What will I be met with in terms of response if I do ask for help? So I think it's important to have a specific agreement about, besides supervision scheduled times, how do I bring up concerns? What if I brought up a concern and felt like something needed to be changed? How would it be handled? How do I ask a supervisor how he or she prefers to be approached? And I think there should be, in that agreement, a sense that both supervisor and supervisee will think ahead, even before the scheduled supervision session, about how they will handle concerns. I've actually included in your PowerPoints a list of potential questions or guidelines that could help a supervisee about asking for help. Can you give me some ideas about how to avoid giving advice when clients keep asking? How would I do this paperwork? Could you mind reviewing it with me? Where can I find resources on such and such topic? Can you help me explore some feelings that I have about this? My client reminds me of such and such. How can I deal with that? Can we discuss options of how to approach treatment with so and so? How can I build trust and rapport, Bill Rogers process variables when I have this challenging client? I'm not sure why I'm stuck with this certain situation, but I feel like I need some guidance. I'm not sure I documented this right. Can you help me? I'm not sure that I handled this ethically. Can I have your guidance? So I wanted to give some guidelines because in the times I've worked with supervisees, sometimes they've told me they even have a hard time putting things into words. Even when they know they have questions, they're not sure how to ask the question sometimes. So there's an analogy called smarter in the literature. Some of the things that are looked at are, what are the definitions of what's required? How is it measurable to what? How will I know when we've achieved the goal? Is the goal achievable? Is it realistic? Is it relevant to what the client's coming in for? Is it time-bounded? What's the date or the time frame by which we should meet this? Is there a way we're going to evaluate if progress has been met? And is it something that's reviewed or modified? They give some guidelines in the literature about how to give feedback. Feedback should be considered as tentative. There should be a way of listening both to the supervisor and supervisee. We talk about concrete behavioral goals with clients, but feedback should be concrete, should be behavioral, and it should be respectful. It shouldn't be about critical personal attack on anybody, but it should include positive affirmation of what's going well as constructive criticism. And it should concentrate on what can be done. Not so much that circular why is this happening? Why did you do this? Why didn't you do this other thing? As much as what are we going to do now to help the client? How are we going to approach this from here? One of the other things that I mentioned that can be hard for a supervisee to work on is self-evaluation. That's just a skill that sometimes takes some time to develop. But there's questions that you might have your supervisee ask him or herself to start to look at that. Things like, what are you actively doing to build trust with your client? How do you engage in a therapeutic partnership? How do you confront clients when necessary? How do you assist clients in taking responsibility for their behaviors? What do you do to instill hope? And how do you help clients generalize things outside of sessions? And it's not just important for a supervisee to self-evaluate, but also a supervisor. Is the supervisor in any way possibly contributing to problems? Maybe they're having a bad day and they were extra harsh on the supervisee. What works? What doesn't work? What are some key ethical issues? Most of these we alluded to already, but things like informed consent, being very clear about the supervision relationship, competencies, both in general in terms of scope of practice, as well as multicultural, having boundaries, talking about giving and receiving feedback, and dealing with crisis. Some of the things that should be a red flag for both the supervisee and the supervisor that need to be addressed when they come up are flattery, seductive behavior, desire to discuss sexual issues, feelings of loneliness, overdependence, physical familiarity, meaning that you're around that person so much, or thoughts of your counselor, your supervisor or supervisee, or having fantasies about them between supervision, seeing the other person as special, wanting to talk about personal things with them a lot, mirroring and having parallel process. Keep in mind, when we talk about supervision, as I said before, that with the developmental stages, that supervisees have anxiety. They're being evaluated. They're anxious about that evaluation. They're anxious about how they're, quote, performing or doing therapy with the client. They're anxious because they might have internal conflict going on that they're trying not to share. There may be areas that aren't what they should be in the supervision relationship. There's that power imbalance. And they're fearful about what's going to happen if I do bring up a concern. So a supervisor can really actually make a difference in terms of lessening some of this anxiety by restructuring how they give feedback. By talking about this feeling of anxiety and vulnerability as actually an opportunity for growth. By doing skill building on what is already working well. By helping supervisees access support systems for themselves as a clinician. By maybe modifying supervision style. I know some supervisees may need some direct answers, may need some role modeling of how to do certain techniques, as opposed to just general empathy. So finding out what is needed. One of the things, again, I want to be very clear about, because this could be an ethical issue, is that clinical supervision, administrative supervision, and counseling, all three of those are very different things. While a clinical supervisor may also provide administrative direction about policies and procedures of an agency, that doesn't have to happen. But I want to be very clear that supervision, clinical supervision towards one's licensure, is not counseling. Clinical supervision is surrounding the issue of providing best client care, whereas counseling is talking about development of personal growth, behavior change, and self-understanding in the client. The supervisor is not to be a clinician or be in a clinical role towards that supervisee. Clinical supervision is focused on proficiency of knowledge and skills, but counseling, again, is focused on clientele needs. Clinical supervision is supposed to be short-term, ongoing for development, but basically to meet the requirements for school, for licensure, whereas counseling is really tailored to the client needs. The agenda of supervision is based on what the school, what the board, and what the agency needs. Again, counseling is tailored to the psychosocial needs of the person. We're talking with clinical supervision about the types of skills we've mentioned in today's seminar, about job performance, about learning objectives, about skill building and skill development. But with counseling, we're talking about the skills for day-to-day life for a person. I did want to include in the PowerPoints that that supervision should be multiculturally effective. I did allude to that earlier. But the key, again, is tapping into the self-awareness of what areas might be challenging to broach, what areas need to be dealt with, both for the supervisor and the supervisee. This involves tending to feelings of discomfort when certain issues come up in sessions with a client or in supervision, dealing with racial and identity development, responding non-defensively to times when there's different issues that maybe hit a button inside of you, expanding your clinical experience. I've heard in the literature that minimally people should be at least multiculturally competent with the populations and issues that tend to come into your specific practice work at where you work. In terms of also multicultural supervision, understand the range of differences that clients might bring in. look at the expectations and reevaluating them. Acknowledge power differences. Encourage supervisees to share with supervision their own personal and professional cultural background. Consult colleagues if needed. We all have areas where we may need more information or may need to know about resources or ways of approaching things. Acknowledging where we need to know about more resources. Using self-disclosure when appropriate. Using multicultural readings or role models if needed. And supervisors role modeling that they are multiculturally competent. Some of this may be also in terms of practicum and internship, providing opportunities to work in cross-cultural counseling and therapy. That can really be effective because every practice, every agency is definitely not tapping into the same clientele or same issues. Also keep in mind our training is generally from a Western theoretical perspective, but what we want to do is really focus on the individual perspective that the client's bringing. There's an acronym called FLAVORS, and it talks about, each of those letters talk about a different aspect of the supervision process that's important. F is focusing on client goals. L, listening, empathically and respectfully. A, assessment of the strengths, of the resilience, of the interests, then validating resources and making people aware of additional resources. Oh, openly sharing the impact on daily living. R, replacing information gathering with creative solutions. And S, Socratic dialogue regarding the process. It's important, as I said, if the supervisor is going to be a role model for the supervisee, that a supervisor has appropriate self-care in terms of their own personal life, the interpersonal dynamics and supervision, emotional demands, time management. I think everyone, no matter if you're independently licensed, no matter if you've been 50 years in the field, should have one, ethically for scope of practice, but also for effective work, a team of people that they can go to. It's very important for supervisors to also look in their own life if there's any unresolved issues, to make sure they have a network of people they can go to. By permitting themselves not to be an expert with all the answers or someone, you know, that the supervisee sees as an expert, but to also be someone who's willing to know what they don't know and to role model getting supervision as well. Making sure that things are clear in a contract in terms of what supervision entails. Charging an appropriate fee. Keeping professional development up to date. Knowing and having a plan for de-stressing. So, at this point, we're going to wrap up with the part of the supervision seminar regarding the literature and regarding what the research says. And then we're going to close with a few different case scenarios here. And then I do want to encourage you to make sure that you watch that multicultural video and listen to the audios, the interview with the supervisor and the interview with the supervisee. I think they'll really provide a perspective for you about clinical supervision and what elements are effective. Thank you again for listening to this seminar on ingredients for successful clinical supervision.